is chapter one open in front of you. Let me begin by asking you a question. Are you a glass half full or a glass half empty kind of person? Optimist or a pessimist? Well, I am an optimist, and Laura finds that she often has to give me a healthy dose of realism to get my feet back on the ground when I have wildly optimistic and ambitious plans, maybe about the number of things we can get done in a day or something like that. But when we come to Ecclesiastes, this very unique book in the Old Testament, it sounds like it was written by a glass half empty kind of person. As I heard one preacher say, the book sounds like it was written by a Scottish person, full of Scottish pessimism. I don't know if Angus is tuning in tonight. But what I'm going to do tonight is, as we look at chapter one, is kind of use this as a way of introducing the whole book to you. I think we've managed to have lined up a different preacher for every sermon in our series. And I hope that means as we go through the book, not only will we get kind of different angles as we look at different passages, but we're also going to get different kind of personal reflections on the message of this book. As we therefore keep looking at different parts of the book as we go through, we're going to need to keep in mind some of the big picture stuff, which I'm going to say tonight as we go through. Now, I should say also up at the start that I found a couple of sermons from a previous church in Cambridge really helpful on this. And actually, I'm drawing on them quite heavily in places, which is not what I normally do, but I'm just saying that up front. So what we're going to do is going to look at four questions as we open this book. First of all, who is this book for? Secondly, what does it say? What's the kind of big message? Why should we study it? And then how can we make sense of it today? So question number one, who is this book for? Well, have a look at verse one. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, preacher, that word preacher there, it kind of signifies the leader of the assembly. That is when God gathers his people together, this is the one who will instruct his people. And here, specifically the son of David, the king in Jerusalem, I take it, King Solomon. Now, I think this is the key to the book, is who is writing this. I was brought up thinking that this book of Ecclesiastes is basically written by a Christian pretending to be an agnostic or an atheist. And the teacher really adopts their perspective to show how meaningless life is if you see the world from a kind of agnostic atheist perspective. Have you heard that kind of thing before? So many think it's basically a book addressing skeptics and unbelievers. And then kind of right at the end of the book, as you've gone through all these chapters and chapters and chapters of seeing just how meaningless life is, that suddenly the writer at the end of the book pulls Jesus out of the hat, as it were, and shows us how once we pull Jesus out of the hat, the whole of life makes sense. Jesus is the meaning of life, not the number 42, if you've watched that or read the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe. So Bible-believing Christians have long assumed that the book of Ecclesiastes is an evangelistic track, as it were, for the existentialist, the person who can't make sense of life. But I don't think that's the right way of taking the book. All the way through the book, the preacher is writing as a believer to people who are believers. So all the way through is woven the great truths about God, God as creator, as sustainer, as ruler, doctrines of salvation and judgment are all here, not in massive detail, but assumed all the way through. It's not that Christianity, the message of Christianity, is kind of held to the end. No, it's taken for granted all the way through. The preacher is the preacher in church, not the non-Christian philosopher. So who's the book for? I take it the book is for us. It's written by a preacher for the gathered church. Question number two. What does the book say? What's its message? Well, have a look at verse two. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And it's, well, that sentence I just read to you comes up near the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 8. You can look that up later. And it's what the book is most famous for, isn't it? That word, vanity. Vanities of vanities. Now, some translations have their meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And the Hebrew word which comes underneath vanity or meaninglessness, well, it comes 35 times in the book as a whole. Now, actually, both those translations, whether you go with vanity or meaninglessness, are both a bit misleading. They don't quite hit the nail on the head. The Hebrew word, here we go, get a chance to learn a Hebrew word tonight, is hevel. It's got quite a guttural start at the beginning of it. It's more of a kind of hevel. And the root idea of the word is vapor or mist. The point is that everything in life is kind of elusive, transient. Think of a spray can of deodorant just for a moment. You spray it, and there's something there, but it quickly kind of disappears. It quickly fades and goes into nothing. It is real, but you can't really see it or grasp it or keep it and hold on to it. And the point is that life is like that. Life is fleeting and it's frustrating. One of the preachers I listened to used this illustration of a child. Remember when you're a child, making a sandcastle on the beach. You make an impressive sandcastle, don't you? You think it's amazing and you want to show it off. The most incredible creation. Go back the next day, and what is left? Well, maybe there's a kind of faint kind of outline of what you had created, and that's it best. Usually what's happened is the sea has come in and washed it all away, and there's often no trace at all. And that is what life is like, isn't it? It's so fleeting, and you think, well, why did I bother? It's so frustrating. Well, with that point, with verse two, he then launches off into a bit of poetry. Now, I wasn't very good at poetry at school, and I usually have to check with Laura whether I've understood poetry rightly. But this poetry is so obvious, it's hard to miss the point. His basic point is saying that everything in this world just goes round and round, and it just seems to go nowhere. Have a look at verse four. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. It's true, isn't it? People come and go. Christmases come and go. Birthdays come and go. Yes, there's new babies, as we've had one, and are added to the family. But then older family members die and pass away. There is a constant cycle, the circle of life. And we wonder, when it comes to ourselves, each of us individually, will anyone actually remember us when we're gone? Some may remember us for a while. A very small number of famous people will be remembered for generations. But most of us will be forgotten very quickly. Who knows here the names of their great-grandparents, for instance? What about great-great-grandparents? And it's the same, isn't it? Not just with us as individuals. It's the same with nature itself. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. You see, the sun rises, it sets. It rises, it sets. It rises, it sets. And it just keeps going round and round. It's an endless cycle which seems to come from nowhere and go to nowhere. It's the same with the winds, the writer says, verse 6. And it's the same with the seas, verse 7. So much movement, but where is it going? It just seems to go round and round the same old ways. Now, here's the point of what the preacher is saying with this poetry. If the world goes round and round, if the world is like that, then why should I think that my life will be any different? That's why, actually, just before he launched off into that poetry, I missed out verse 3. Have a look at that. It begins it with a question. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? He's saying that whatever we put all our energy into will ultimately be futile. Our lives will go round and round and never get anywhere because that's what the world is like. Verses 8 to 9. All things are wearisome. A weariness, and a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. You see, we make ourselves busy, don't we, in life? But if we just stop and think, it's not hard to see how true that is. Our lives do seem to go round and round in an endless cycle, not really moving anywhere. Surely we all feel this, don't we? Too often it feels like I'm always emptying the bins, shaving, cutting the grass, getting ready for bed, and it just goes round and round. We've been learning this in a big way with a new baby, probably Laura, well, definitely Laura more than myself. Change his nappy, feed him, burp him, calm him down, eventually get him to sleep, and, well, we start the whole cycle again. We're meant to do it 8 times a day, feed him. That's every 3 hours we go round and round and round and round the cycle. And I don't know what it is for you at the moment in life. Is it the daily grind of the commute, planning school lessons, cleaning the house, yearly task of getting the accounts done? But do we ever get ahead on them? We just go round and round. There'll be some of us who fool ourselves into thinking that's not really reality. I mean, one of the things we do, the big thing we do, is, well, we go for entertainment, isn't it? We have our Netflix subscription and we have it all sorted. We're working our way through series and series and series. And where we delude ourselves into thinking that we're doing something meaningful, we're rising above the going around and round and round, going nowhere. But of course we're not really, are we? We're going round and round with Netflix series. And actually, all we're really doing is, well, distracting ourselves. Blaise Pascal said, distraction is the only thing that consoles us for our miseries. Yeah, this life does go round and round, and all we do is to try and handle it is we distract ourselves. We entertain ourselves to death. Life really is, if we admit it, life on a hamster wheel. And I could say it's no different in Christian ministry. I think maybe when I was younger, I'd look at the kind of pastor of the church and think, well, it must be different. You know, you're on a different kind of spiritual plane. You must escape all that. Well, it's not at all. You know, I write sermon each week. There's a big push to get them done for each Sunday. And then I have a slump on Monday. And, well, some people, it seems that, you know, get something out of each sermon each week. But by the next week, even I, as the preacher, have forgotten most of what I said the Sunday before. And it's hard to escape the feeling you're not just kind of going round and round and round and round. So what do we get from all this work? There's no destination or progress, it often feels like. We may fool ourselves into thinking there is. But actually, with so much in life, there just isn't. We love to dream of progress. We love that dream, don't we? We always like to have newer and better gadgets, but it's just going round and round. There's always the blast of having a new phone, but 3 years before we thought the new phone we had at that point was amazing, and now it just seems so old. And that's just the going around and round, isn't it? But we don't really get anywhere. I remember a disturbing moment when I worked out, it was a few years back, I worked out that I probably had, if I had the innings which most of us have in this life, another 14,000 days to live. And now I think back to that moment I spotted that and worked it out, though I've already burnt off a few thousand of those since that time. Life is like sand slipping through the fingers. All the gadgets and trinkets of this world are in the end just a distraction. We go round and round, not really going anywhere. So why do we need this book? Well, I think we probably need this book. Yes, it feels this kind of discouraging, depressing, and not very comfortable to hear. But I think we need it in a strange way to better enjoy life. That is, to enjoy life in a more grown-up kind of way. You see, in verses 12 to 18, the writer tells us that he has pursued wisdom. He tells us that he tries to fathom it all out. But the only wisdom he can really get to is to see that life is all vapor. It is all, there's vanity. Verse 13, 14, have a look at that. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. You see, everything under the sun is, well, everything. It just goes on in this world. All of life is that in the end, it's vapor, passing mist. Even wisdom itself, Solomon says here. And Solomon had gained, well, unrivaled wisdom, hadn't he? Verse 16, that wisdom is, well, 17, but vapor. And he explains in verse 18, for in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Where you know more, you understand more, so you worry more, he says. The only wisdom chapter 1 leaves us with is that everything in life is vapor. But that's far from useless, for I want to suggest it leads us better to enjoy life. I have a friend who's a very laid-back character, and he likes to say this: the best way to avoid disappointment in life is not to have high expectations in the first place. The best way to avoid disappointment in life is not to have high expectations in the first place. Now, my knee-jerk reaction to hearing that is to either laugh it off or push back, because I like to have high expectations. I'm an optimist. I'm a glass half full kind of person. But I wonder, just reflecting on it this week, whether my friend is actually not that far away from the message of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. I sometimes wonder where my high expectations come from. I do have such a deep conviction that, well, things in life are heading somewhere great. And that, well, things are a bit rubbish and a bit confusing at the moment. Not to worry, because they'll work themselves out and they will get somewhere great in the end. I sometimes wonder where that comes from. I'm told that my generation, Generation Y, that's everyone who was born between the late 1970s and the mid-1990s, and I was on the earlier side of that, are often unhappy. And that's because of the expectations which were hammered into us early in life. The theory goes that the generation before us worked hard and had done well for themselves, better than the previous generation anyway, on the whole, worked hard and managed to do better. And on top of that, not only did all that kind of feed into my generation, that our generation were told, especially were told, each of us was special. We could all realise our dreams. In my book, Disney has a lot to answer for on this. It has duped a generation into expecting life to be great. Yes, there will be struggles, but in the end, we will all get to a happy place. Everyone is destined to a make-believe ending. And the problem is that gap between expectations and reality ends up crushing us. We pour all our energy into our dreams and then we find they don't come true. And Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and the rest of the book comes along and says, get real. That is, well, life. And if you get your expectations real, then you will start to enjoy more. You will enjoy what is good in life, rather than being constantly disappointed with what you don't have and what hasn't come true. Now, this is true even for us as Christians, isn't it? In fact, we can do the Christian version of Disney. If I just do the right thing by God, then he will make my dreams come true, we tell ourselves. But Ecclesiastes says that's not actually reality. If we don't have our expectations about life right, then we'll be left wide open to being crushed, to despair, to disappointment, to anger, to resentment, and all the rest. And all that comes from a gap between reality and expectations. And this becomes a big issue in our Christian discipleship, because as Christians, that anger, resentment, and all the rest of it will turn against God, won't we? We'll turn it against God if we don't have realistic expectations in life. I caught myself trapped in that place this week. I was up in the morning earlier than I'd like. The baby was screaming and just wouldn't stop screaming. And I was struggling to make progress on other things. I was reflecting on how other people in life seem to have achieved more of what I wanted to achieve in life by the same age as me. I was comparing myself with them. I was frustrated that a big project I'd been working on had got stuck and was going nowhere, and other people weren't responding to it. And it just ends up seeming to get frustrating. And it's easy to turn that anger against God, and it's to start driving a wedge between me and God. But the problem Ecclesiastes says I haven't got what the world is like. And maybe this whole coronavirus thing with the lockdown, the restrictions, and all the frustrations which have come with that. Well, maybe God's allowed that for this lesson to come into our hearts, that we realize this is what the world is like. And when it is good, that's the exception. So strangely then, I think Ecclesiastes helps us to enjoy life more when we get our expectations right. It does help us to deal with disappointment, anger, resentment, regrets, and comparisons. Question number 4, how can we make sense of it? Well, I'm kind of reluctant to leave us on a negative note tonight, though this book has got quite a lot of things which sound a bit gloomy. And there's obviously much more to come in the coming weeks. And the book, as I'll mention in a moment, has its own conclusion. What I want to do is just kind of do a fast forward and a sneak preview of the end of the book, just to help us to kind of get orientated with where the book's going. Yes, we're freed from disappointment, anger, resentment, regrets, and comparisons, and all the rest by having right expectations. But what is it kind of positively we should aim at? What can we hold on to? Well, here's chapter 12, last two verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Yes, this life does feel a life of fleeting frustrations. But I think what the writer's saying is the key is, well, how we walk through life. The book wants to point us to how we conduct ourselves before God. You may feel like your life doesn't really add up to much, and there's not much point in a lot of what we do. But God will see how you live, how you handle the path he has called you to walk. For it is the final judgment where meaning will come and this fleeting frustration world will pass for good. And on that day, God will look at our lives in this world and ask how if we walked in this life. And I think this helps us to make sense of it as Christians, to stand back and fit it into our big kind of worldview as Christians. You see, the world Ecclesiastes is talking about is the world of Genesis chapter 3. The Bible begins with the world God makes and declares it very good. But that tragic ending, well, that comes to a tragic end with Adam and Eve, with them turning from God. This world becomes a broken and fallen world. And Genesis 3 comes. It's a world of curse and death and pain and futility. It's the world of Ecclesiastes chapter 1, isn't it? And Adam and Eve actually, back in Genesis, have a son. And what do they name him? They name him Abel. The Hebrew pronunciation, the word literally, Hevel. That very same word which comes up 35 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. See, Adam and Eve get this point that this world is what? A world of fleeting frustrations. But the big story of the Bible is it ends with a perfect world to come, a world that far surpasses even the world at first, a world of heaven on earth. And that is what the end of the Bible talks about. So here's Romans 8. Paul writes, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom and the glory of the children of God." That word for futility is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word hevel. This world is a futile world. It's vanity. But it has been frustrated by God in hope. In hope that God will free this world from its present frustration and bring it into something greater. In the end, this world is going somewhere. In the end, the Disney dream will come true. There will be a happily ever after. But it's on the other side of that judgment day Ecclesiastes 12 talks about. So what matters in the end as we go through this book is how we live before God in all the fleeting futility of this world. And so it's these truths we're going to need to hold on to as we go through this book, and we see the writer explore this whole idea from different angles. But let me leave you all with that this week. Amen.